Hebrews 16, 24 through 25. You can follow along in your Bible or on screen as I read the passage aloud to us. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." This is God's word.
Well, good morning. Over the past 4 weeks, we've been in a series on the journey of Christian identity. And from the first week, I've been saying that the subject that we've been in of identity, of like finding an identity and making an identity or receiving an identity, is incredibly difficult. And sometimes it's impossibly difficult. Identity is hard because who you are or who you know yourself to be is terribly complex. Now, as we get into today's teaching, what I like to do is I like to begin with a few quotes to frame up what I want to talk about. I'm calling today's sermon Knowing God and Knowing Self. So the first quote to frame up our time is a quote by Thomas Merton. Thomas Merton is a monk, activist, theologian, mystic, writer, scholar. He writes this in the book New Seeds of Contemplation. "There is only one problem on which all my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend: to discover myself in discovering God. If I find him, I will find myself, and if I find my true self, I will find him." Someone a little bit less, you might go, "That guy's really contemplative, and I don't really know. I think he's like Catholic, I don't know." Okay, what about this guy? John Calvin, for everyone else in the room, wrote in his opening of the Institutes of Christian Religion, he says, quote, "Our wisdom consists almost entirely of two parts, the knowledge of God and of ourselves. But as these are connected together by many ties, it is not easy to determine which of the two precedes and gives birth to the other." Or what about Augustine, before there was a Catholic-Protestant divide or even Eastern-Western Orthodox divide? He wrote this in Confessions: "How can you draw close to God when you are far from your own self?" And then he says, he prayed this: "Grant, Lord, that I may know myself, that I may know thee. Grant that I may know myself, so that I may know thee." Now, all of these quotes are very profound. And it's my hope today to teach what these quotes mean and how they work together to bring about what Merton called my existence, my peace, and my happiness. That's the hope. That's the goal for the day. But here's the problem. We all know the problem. I've been talking about the problem for the last 4 weeks. The problem is we have only been told, not taught, we've been told this. No one teaches us how to do this. We've been told to go and find a self, to go and make a self, to become a self in the world. And no one teaches us how to do this. We just got to figure this out ourselves. And this cultural command has left us so overwhelmingly tired. And not just like I lost an hour of sleep last night, tired because of the government, or who takes the hour away? I don't know. Farmers? Someone does, right? No one knows who takes the hour away, but someone takes the hour away, right? It's not that kind of tired. It's not just a lack of sleep tired. Many of us are soul tired. A deep fatigue that we experience as restlessness. We might even say depression. We suffer in staggering numbers with depression and anxiety as a culture. And why? Alain Ehrenberg, a French sociologist, wrote a very popular clinical book on depression called this. And just the title of the book itself just kind of gives the whole book away: The Weariness of the Self. And you feel that even just, that the book cover, everything about that book, just like, yes, that. What is that? The French title is a little bit more on point. The French title is The Weariness of Being a Self. The subtitle is Diagnosing the History of Depression in the Contemporary Age. And he says that the staggering rates and ubiquitous presence of depression in our society is directly linked to our contemporary society's obligation to constantly construct and maintain your own identity. That's the premise of the book. In this book, he writes that our modern condition of selfhood has left us without guides. The modern condition of selfhood, like go and find a self, has left us without guides, without reference points, because there are no guides to find yourself anymore. There are no reference points. He says the old reference points, like religion or community, have all eroded away. There's no one to help us find who we are. And we have become individuals, he says. Individuals. You're like, yeah, I'm an individual. He says we've become individuals in the purest sense of the word. That word individual literally means, individual means a single human as distinct from a group. We have literally become that. We are distinct from any group, and we are ourselves, with no moral law or tradition that can tell us who we must be and how we must behave. Those are all eroded now. In other words, you're free. You and I are free. There's no social pressure anymore. There's no religious pressure anymore to have to be something and behave in a certain way, as long, of course, as it doesn't harm anybody. But we're free. You and I are free to become whatever we want. We've thrown off old traditions. We've thrown off old things. We've seen these old movies where these people have to become something or they have to live into this thing. We've thrown all of those off. We're free to be us. And therefore, we're free to become not what is allowed or forbidden, because that's a traditional model of identity. A traditional model of identity is you become what is allowed for you to become, what you must become, and you cannot become what is forbidden to become. You're to become. You can't do that. So you have to live in this strict kind of bubble. You're free from that. You're free to become not what is allowed or forbidden. You're free to become whatever is possible. You and I are told you can become whatever is possible through technology, You're free to become whatever you want. And herein lies the paradox. This freedom that we have has turned into a form of captivity and oppression. Ehrenberg says that this way of being human has left us with a collective pathology. He writes, quote, "Depression is the pathology of a society whose norm is no longer based on guilt and discipline, but on responsibility and initiative." Now, keep that quote up there because I need to explain this. When we read this quote, we are like, yeah, of course, guilt and discipline, that sounds horrible. For responsibility and initiative, yeah, that's me. This is what he means by these two things. What he means by guilt and discipline is this. Think of discipline as like a disciple or as an apprentice or a learner becoming something. There was an old way of identity where you would just become someone in that society that you were meant to be. So society or religion said, this is who you are. And then guilt, internal guilt, you kind of drove you forward in becoming that thing. Guilt was like, am I doing my best? Am I living into what I'm meant to be by this, the society or religion or family or whatever else puts on me? So it's like, it's discipline. I have to become this thing. And I'm going to work really hard to become this thing. And then you have the guilt of like, am I doing that thing right or not? That was the old way. Now, that way is gone now. And in some ways, that's really, really good that it's gone. But what's replaced it is not better. What replaced it is what he calls responsibility and initiative. What he means by that, he means that we have the responsibility to go out into this great big world and find who we are and become who we really are. And thus, what drives us forward is initiative. We have to take initiative to get up and make something out of this one life that we have. No one will tell us what we are. No one will even really guide us. Everyone's way too afraid of putting something on us that's not us. But we have the responsibility to find ourselves, and so we have to have the initiative and the drive to go out and do so. That's what he's saying. And therefore, he says, that the depressed person is the person who is out of fuel, who is out of battery, who is out of gas, who can no longer keep constructing and maintaining their unique identities. We're all left exhausted and weary of being a self in this world. He says, quote, depression is particular, since it marks the helplessness of existence, be it expressed through sadness, fatigue, inhibition, or the inability to initiate action. The depressed individual, caught in a moment with no tomorrow, is left without drive, bogged down in a nothing is possible. Tired and empty, restless and violent, in short, nervous. And here's the line. We feel the weight of our individual sovereignty. We are all sovereign selves that have to make a self, find a self, become a self, and show that self to the world that we have actually become a self. What Ehrenberg is saying is it's almost as if the more we focus on ourselves, the more miserable we are. Like the more we try to find ourselves, the more lost we get. Like the more we try to find inner peace, the more restless we all become. We're all so restless, but we have all of the technology and the apps to become chill in our hands, but it doesn't ever work. Why? Ehrenberg says, because your whole paradigm is to go and make a self, so you have to stack all of these like mindfulness things and align your work up to who you are, and you have to build your relationships and choose a location and choose a spouse or not a spouse, all out of like who the self-creation project is, and it's all so freaking exhausting, and it leads us into depression. Now, we all live here now. This is, as he says, our collective pathology. What do we do? One more quote from Jesus. And this should be familiar to you because we've read it every week over the last month. Jesus says this: whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it. But whoever loses their life for me will find it. I think what's so remarkable about Jesus' words here is that Jesus right here is at the threshold of calling disciples. He's calling people like to himself to become like him. In our modern vernacular, he's calling people to become Christians, to become his disciples. And to make this call, Jesus puts his finger on something the human soul has wanted for forever, for two millennia. Today, 2,000 years ago, and before that, and it's this: we have this innate drive to find and thus save ourselves. We know we're kind of exiled in this world, and we want nothing more than to find ourselves and save ourselves. And what Jesus is saying is that if you want to find yourself, which we all do, you have to lose yourself and follow him. We said last week that the word that Jesus uses for life right there, but whoever wants to save their life, that word life is not the word like life like vitality or aliveness. There's a word for that in Greek. That word for in Greek is zoe. It's a beautiful word. It means vitality, life, aliveness. It means your life. Jesus isn't saying give up your life, your vitality, your aliveness to find a life. The word Jesus uses is not zoe, but psuche. Psuche is where, in Greek, is where we get the word psyche or psychology. It means your personhood, your personality, your identity, the core of one's being, which means this is not all doom and gloom. You might be reading this and you're like, oh my gosh, like how does anyone become a Christian? Well, in one sense, that's true. It's like really hard, but it's not doom and gloom. Jesus is not saying ignore yourself, lose yourself to be lost, forget all of your possibilities of the self, because he doesn't say that, because he actually wants you to find yourself. See, at the end, he's like, if you lose yourself, you'll find yourself. And that's what I want for you, and that's what you want for you. You will find yourself. And Jesus isn't saying that you have to, like, die, as in your life breath or your vitality. That's not what we're taught by Jesus to lose. We don't lose our zoe. We are called to lose our psyche. In other words, by following Jesus, we have to be willing to lose and give up our pursuit of finding a self by looking for a self, or making a self, or in Jesus' words, saving our self. That project has to end. And that's good news, because this project is leaving us burnt out and weary. A new project now has to begin. And that's the discipleship project of knowing Jesus, of knowing and learning God. And in that great all-consuming project of learning Jesus, of knowing God, we learn to know ourselves, our true selves. And as we do, we come to know God more. And as we come to know God more, we learn ourselves more. And we learn to know God more deeply. And then as we do, we learn ourselves even deeper. And it keeps on going. As Thomas Merton said, if I find him, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find him. And that cycle keeps going over and over and over again. How does that work? Now, here's as simple as I can say it. It still sounds very mystical. But here it is. Here's like, how do I find a true self? How do I know my true self? And here's the answer to that. Your true self is the self that is known by God. Therefore, your true self can only be found in the transformational knowledge of God. Your true self is only known by God. God is the only one who knows who you really are, your true self. And in order to know that true self, you have to dive into God. And as you know God, you will learn the self. And as you learn yourself, you will learn God. Now, let me unpack this a little further. Only God knows who you truly are. Only God. And this is because God made you. You are his beloved creation. I think we all either know this deeply or we want this to be true deep down. Okay, we started with the Barbie movie. Let's pick back up. Even the Barbie movie, which is a movie on identity, can't escape this reality. Because, as we all know, the climax of the movie is Barbie meeting her maker, and then only then can she become her true self. These secular thinkers telling a secular story about identity still can't do this without going, oh, what happened? Oh, she has to meet her maker. She has to meet the person who gave her life, who brought her to life for her to get unstuck to move forward. It's the only way that she moves forward. And that happens, and subsequently Barbie changes her name to her maker's name. There it is. Go watch it. I promise you it'll be way better for you now. These continual knowings and encounters with God, we know who we are. We meet God, and then we meet ourselves for the first time. This is like Nathaniel going to Jesus, like we just did that meditation, and like, how did you know me? How did you know who I am? Jesus is like, I see you. And as you see me, you'll also see you, and then you'll see me, and then you'll see you. And that thing goes on over and over and over again. See, God is the only context in which your being makes sense. God is the only context in which your being makes sense. Old Testament scholar Bruce Waukee said this: God created humanity, and therefore only God can reveal to us our identity and function. Without this biblical revelation, we are lost in a maze of confusion. Now, research would support this lost in confusion bit. Now, let me try to show you what this looks like practically by looking at one of Jesus' first disciples, Peter. So Peter meets Jesus, and this is in all the Gospels. So Peter meets Jesus, and at that time, his name is not Peter, it's Cephas. And Jesus calls Peter to follow him, and he literally drops everything at that very moment. He was a fisherman. According to the Gospels, he wasn't a great fisherman, but he was a fisherman. And he drops his nets. He like leaves behind that thing and follows Jesus. Now, if it was a documentary, if we just pulled him aside after he did that, and like, Peter, when Jesus just called you to follow him, what do you know about Jesus at that time? And he probably would say something like, "Well, I believe that he's the awaited Messiah. He's the awaited Messiah. He's the one we've been waiting for. And I believe that, being the Messiah, Jesus will deliver us from the oppression of the Romans, and I want to help in that great campaign, so I'm following him." And if we said, okay, well, Peter, what do you know about yourself? Who are you? And Peter would probably go, well, I'm a fisherman. like my father. That's what I am. I'm a fisherman. He might even confess, and he might even say something like, well, and I'm like, well, what about, what's your personality? What about you? Who are you? And he's like, well, I'll confess, I have a bit of an anger problem. I'm a bit impulsive, you know, evidence. I just dropped my nets to follow this guy. Like, I'm like, it's right there. I'm going to do it. Let's do this, right? He might have said how he deeply longed for a savior who would destroy the Romans. Like, that's what he was brought up to like, really want. But what Peter didn't know at that time was the depths of his fears or the magnitude of his pride. It was hidden to him. Those levels of knowing of himself required a deeper knowing of God. And so, with each day of knowing Jesus, he also learned a little bit about himself. And this happens throughout Peter's life. Peter is talked about more than any other disciple because most of us can find ourselves in Peter. Fast forward 3 years. 3 years into following Jesus every single day, in the flesh, you might think you know Jesus. And you know yourself pretty well too. You've learned Jesus, you've learned yourself. It's Passover, which is going to be happening in a few weeks' time. Jesus starts saying that this is his last night eating with them. Jesus washes their feet. And then Jesus says to Peter, Peter, you're going to deny me 3 times. I'm going to be arrested, betrayed, arrested, and you're going to deny me 3 times. To which Peter said, there's no way on God's green earth that I'm going to betray you. There's absolutely no way. See, though Peter has learned a lot about Jesus and himself over the 3 years, the depth of Peter's pride and fear wouldn't be known to himself until that night. Peter thought denying Jesus was impossible. Peter was offended. Peter was like, do you even know how much I love you? Like, not only am I willing to not deny you, I will die for you, I will kill for you, whatever it takes. I got you. I have your back. Like, I'm 100% in, all the way in. What he didn't know was that his pride that was he kept hidden, and his fear that he kept hidden. I mean, Jesus named him the rock. Like, literally named him rock, Peter. Some say it's like pebble, but it doesn't matter. It's still in the rock family, right? It's like, I'm the rock. Jesus, I'm not going anywhere. Remember my name? You gave me a name, rock. I'm your rock. Lean on me. I got you. Then Jesus gets arrested and tortured, and the whole Messiah project comes tumbling down, and Peter denies Jesus once, denies Jesus twice, denies Jesus a third time, and then a rooster crows. And it's here, at this moment, that Peter encountered his weakest and most despicable self that was even hidden to himself. And he was likely filled with self-loathing, like, that was in me? He probably didn't even know he was capable of such denial, of such fear, of such cowardice. Fast forward 3 days. Jesus is said to be alive. Spoiler alert, we're going to talk about that in a few weeks. Just act like I never said that, okay? Peter is out fishing again because Peter's like, what am I going to do now? Like, the campaign's over. So he goes back to what he did before. He goes out fishing. And it says, you know, Peter's not that great at fishing. So they fished all night and caught nothing. Just like before, right? Still can't fish. Still doesn't want to face up to that fact, but that's different. So Jesus is on the shore, and he's cooking. He has a fire going, and he calls out to the boat. And Peter, it says that Peter says, it's the Lord. And he jumps in the water to swim to shore. Now, they could row. They can row the boat to shore. But that was not good enough for Peter. He's like, no, I'm not rowing. I'm a swim. So he jumps in the water, swims to Jesus. And Jesus has breakfast going. Fish, loaves, because he didn't have fish. And Jesus looks at Peter, and he doesn't bring up the denial. Peter knows. Jesus knows. Jesus just asks 3 different times, Peter, do you love me? 3 times. Why 3 times? 3 times denied. He allows Peter to like say 3 different times, I love you. And it's right there at that moment that Peter's false self is faced and finally let go. Never hidden to Jesus. Jesus knew this about Peter since the very beginning, but it was always hidden to Peter. What Peter would become and what Peter had to die to and what Peter had to let go of so that Peter could actually become himself was only known to Jesus. And through knowing Jesus, it began to be known to Peter himself. At that moment, he knows Jesus, and not just knows Jesus, he knows the depths of Jesus' love and forgiveness because he has to rely on it with his whole being. If you ask Peter after that breakfast, looking back what he knew of himself and of God at the very beginning, I think he would say something like how little he had truly known either himself or Jesus before. Like, I didn't really know myself. I didn't really know Jesus. And with regards to Jesus, he probably would have said something like, I had no idea how deeply loving and forgiving Jesus was. See, you can never be other than who you are until you embrace the full reality of who you are. The shadow side, the ego, like the thing that you show up with to the world, that like the face you put on, the thing that you want to show that you're strong and you're competent. So basically you show up with your like interview resume sort of thing. It's like, what's your greatest weakness? My greatest weakness is I work really too hard. I just am so committed. That's my greatest weakness. I don't know when to stop. It's that sort of thing. The thing that you say, that thing, this ego that we keep in front of us, or the shadow that we keep hidden, even from ourselves. Those like dark, dark secrets. The ones that if they ever got out, God would banish us forever. So we keep them hidden even to ourselves. Only when you embrace the reality of who you are can you truly become who you are most deeply called to be. Until you're able to face all of who you are. Now, the way this takes place is with and only through interaction with God, back and forth with God, of looking at God and then looking at self, and then looking back at God and then looking at self. Now, if you just look at God, this is a temptation. If you just look at God and not yourself, these people are very dangerous. Very, very dangerous. People, leaders, who are a stranger to themselves, but have a lot of knowledge of God, they do the most damage in the church, especially. They think knowledge of God is enough, that their success is enough. And now there's documentaries and podcasts are made about such leaders. I know that because I was there once. I was taught to be this person in the church. I didn't grow up in church. When I did come to church and started following Jesus, like, you know, like late teens and early 20s, I was taught that this is how you acted. You presented something at church, and then you were someone different at home. You were someone different in private. You were this here, and then someone different there. You had to be. And so leaders in the church, maybe even people in the church, are taught, no, you show up to church like this, but who you really are is, or who you keep hidden from everyone is this. And you continue to know God, and what happens is it just builds in you pride and ego, and it's so dangerous. I remember when I first began to become like kind of awakened to the reality that I have to know myself in order to fully know God. That was a strange concept to me. And I went out with my mentor, and I asked him, I grew up in a church that was like, deny yourself, deny yourself, deny yourself. It's not about you, it's not about you. Die, 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 that sort of thing. But I'm learning now that I have to know myself in order to know God. I said, how do you know yourself and deny yourself at the same time? And I remember my mentor saying, that's a good question. And I remember going, thank you, thank you, thank you very much. That was a good question. He said this, you have to deny your false self so that your true self can emerge. I'll say it one more time. You have to deny your false self, which means your false self has to actually emerge. It has to show up. It has to, like, be confronted. If you hide your false self from yourself, you can never deny that part of you because you don't think it exists. These are people that are not self-aware. These are leaders that are not self-aware. These are spiritual leaders that are not self-aware. I'm like, do you realize how angry you are? Do you realize how arrogant you are? Do you, like, they're like a stranger to themselves. Do you see how disconnected from yourself? Like, am I even talking to a real person? This is what happens when you hide yourself and don't bring your whole self to God. So the denial of self is the denial of a false self. It's bringing all of yourself to God, and then your false self can emerge, and then to know what parts to deny. And what parts need to be redeemed, because sometimes we keep parts hidden. They're just hidden because of shame, family of origin stuff, that are actually part of who we are, but we just never want to grab onto that because of shame. And that needs to come out too. See, this process is really, really hard. It takes spiritual direction. Sometimes it takes therapy. It takes knowing God, all of that. But here's the other side of that. Don't overcorrect. Sometimes we overcorrect and we pursue self-knowledge apart from knowing our identity in relationship to God. This is people that are just hyper-addicted to therapy. They only do therapy. They have to know themselves. They have to know themselves. They have to know themselves. Not themselves in relation to God, but just themselves for themselves. And this leads to self-preoccupation and self-fixation, and thus it leads to depression. David Benner says, knowing God and knowing self are interdependent. Neither can proceed very far without the other. Paradoxically, we come to know God best, not by looking at God exclusively, but by looking at God and then looking at ourselves, then looking at God and then looking at ourselves. This is also the way we best come to know ourselves. Both God and self are mostly fully known in relationship to each other. Okay, so my sermon is kind of done. I've wanted to say two things for the last 4 weeks, and I can never fit them into the flow of a sermon. So I'm just gonna like jam them in right here. They don't make sense. Like, that was all like, there was a flow of thought there, okay? These don't fit into that flow of thought. These are just two random things that I wanna leave with you. Here they are. How do you begin to find God and self in this modern world, this contemporary society, this cultural moment? Two things, practically. Number one, make and keep promises. Make promises and keep promises. You will become your promises. See, we're taught that life today is all about you. And not just all about you, but all about what you want right now. And not just about what you want right now, but what your base appetites want right now, regardless of the cost to yourself or to society. But when you make a promise, you have to rearrange your life around someone or something else. So this could be a promise to a people, like your community group, like your promise, like, I'm gonna show up. And I'm not gonna like text you 2 hours before group saying, my throat is itching, I don't wanna make anyone sick. I'm gonna show up. I'm gonna be there. You make a promise to a community. You make a promise to a vocation. You make a promise to a place. I don't know, just add it randomly. San Francisco, let's just say. You made a promise to stay. Okay. You made a promise to marriage. You make a promise to your singleness, to chastity and holiness in both marriage and singleness. You make a promise. Now, when you make a promise, you bind yourself to this promise, and as you do, your life is fortified around it. And as you do, you will get to know By keeping this promise, you will know more deeply yourself and God. The thing is, a lot of people, especially in cities like San Francisco, are so scared of commitment. And they oftentimes say they're depressed. Those two things are connected. You're probably afraid. What if I choose the wrong city? What if I choose the wrong spouse? What if I choose the wrong community? What if I choose the wrong church? What if I choose the wrong vocation? And the thing is, you probably will. You probably will. But your promise, your vow to that thing, will itself transform you into someone and transform that thing into something. We always think it's better out there somewhere else. Like, I'll eventually make a commitment when I find the perfect setting. And we both know that's not gonna happen, ever. That will never happen. But to choose, and to choose and to say yes to this thing that you chose, even as everyone in life keeps moving this way and you feel like you're here, that you will become someone doing that. So this will test your pride and your selfishness, and it's the only way to truly grow. So start making and keeping promises. Second thing, become like a child. I told you these two things are not connected. You're like, what? Be an adult and make promises and be like a kid? Yes. Become like a child. So there was a question asked of Jesus, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And we all want to be great. We all want to do great things. Who's the greatest? And then Jesus grabs a child and puts a child on his lap and says this, unless you change and become like a little child, unless you change and become like a little child, you will not inherit the kingdom of heaven. See, when you were a child, you had certain qualities and characteristics that were innate. You trusted your parents without rationale when you were really small, or your caregivers. You were creative and imaginative. You were not so self-conscious. And then you changed. You grew up. You turned away and pushed yourself into the world to find or make or become yourself. And then you're confronted with Jesus' call as a Christian to like deny yourself or lose yourself and become like a child. What do we make of this? Children are unconsciously children. They trust by default. They are filled with wonder and curiosity unconsciously. They want snuggles and touch. They depend all by default. It's all unconscious. It's all just happening to them. And so, like, my daughter Juniper will just ask me for anything and everything. We're out running errands the other day, and we're walking by a store. Dad, let's go in the store. I'm like, why? I want you to buy me something. I'm like, what? Why? I don't know. Let's just go in there and buy something. I need something. I'm like, what do you need? She goes, I don't know. We'll figure it out when we get inside. I'm like, we're not doing that. We're doing the errands and we have to go home. So, but Jesus says that this is the kind of people that have faith. These kind of people that are so audacious to ask God for like the simplest things, to depend on God like a child. They also know, children also know intuitively, unconsciously, that they are limited and they need help. My daughter has memorized maybe 2-3 books, and over us reading them, she knows how to kind of read them to her brother, like just by memory, by pictures and memory. And then she'll pick up a book that she can't read. I'm like, Junie, you know, you can read that book. And she goes, Dad, you know I can't read. I just get over here and read this book. I mean, she doesn't talk that adult, but almost, right? She is not afraid to tell you what she can't do in order to receive help. We grow out of that. Now, as an adult, the process of Christian identity formation is becoming like a child consciously. They're children unconsciously. We have to become children consciously by denying ourselves. The self that builds up residue and hardened walls that protects and hides and doesn't trust. That becomes self-reliant and thinks that everything is up to us. That has to go. Consciously, it has to go to become interdependent on God. And this is the process of maturing. And a lot of us get stuck. We get stuck in the self-reliance. We get stuck in the making of ourselves. And life doesn't go our way. And then we get resentful. And we get stuck. This is the movie Up, by the way. The movie Up is about an older man who gets stuck. See, the process of aging is you're a child, and you grow and you age, and then you kind of age like a child. You should, at the end of your life, have a kind of joy, a kind of like, you could wear your pants high with suspenders, and it's cute, right? And you're like, you're like a kid all over again. That's kind of the arc of a mature life. But in Up, he gets stuck, and he's bitter. He's resentful. And it takes a little child to be inserted into his life to get him unstuck. And then by the end of the movie, he becomes like a child. And so at the end of the movie, there's all these pictures, right? Of like them doing childlike things, like balloons and ice cream and Boy Scouts and all of these things. The arc is completed finally because he was stuck. What Jesus is saying is that life should age that way, but for Christian maturity, you shouldn't have to wait till you're 80. It starts now. It's this like childlike thing of you becoming a dependent child upon God with a joy in God. And knowing fully that God will supply all of your needs, even if you don't understand how that all works out. That's the thing that God is looking for. That actually begins the process of knowing who you are.